you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Today, we have a new podcaster presenting his story for you. His name is Devin Field. He runs the podcast called The Human Circus, which tells the story of people who lived during the Middle Ages. The story you're going to hear today is set in medieval England during its conquest by the Mongols. What? That's right. The Mongols conquered England. When I read through Devin's script, I kept saying, yes, yes, yes. He was checking every box. Great storytelling, great characterization, great style, well-researched, and what I loved most, he did something unique with the Twilight Histories that I'd never heard before. What I love about this story is this ever-present theme of dreaming that seems to weave its way through everything. The main character reminds me of a Sufi mystic caught somewhere between this world and something more magical. You swim between reality and metaphor, mission and poetry. At points, there is violence, but the violence is almost impressionistic, something to be pondered, reflected upon, and maybe later, dreamed. A huge thank you to all the new patrons, Kevin Comer, Jamie's RPG Art, and man, that's some sweet art, Sins of Anglo, and Matthew Carmody. You guys rock. This show is for you. And now, The Con of England, Part 1, by Devin Field of the Human Circus Podcast.
Oh good, you're awake. No, don't get up. Give yourself a moment. I am, after all, here on your time. You see, they told me that I could find you out here. They told me you had taken to sleeping on the ground when with us, an affectation picked up on a past assignment. They told me your methods had become unorthodox in that way, and in other ways. That you were said to pick up habits, shall we say, from the timelines you visit. That you cultivate a taste for producing Safavid miniature. That you chant the words of the Icelandic Eddas. That you even practice at times with a replica Roman pilum. Though I'm not sure whether or not I actually believe that. Not everyone here approves of that sort of thing, you know. Still, you have proven yourself effective and adaptable, so perhaps you should get up now. You have somewhere to be. No, there's no need to change your clothes. That sleeping sleeve will do just fine. Your costume is already laid out, ready and waiting. You'll find I have everything ready for you. It's just this way. The timeline you're to be sent to is, how should I put this? Confused, unsettled, uncertain. Something is odd. It needs examining, needs an expert on the ground set of eyes before we consider sending back anyone else. And that, of course, is where you come in. And here we are. Do you recognize the clothes? Good. Yes, Persian it is. No, not quite Timurid. Earlier. Let me color in the background a little. You're familiar, of course, with the thread of the Mongols in our history, with their sweep westward across the steppe, and on into the lands of the Rus in the 1230s, their sacking of Kiev in 1240, their advance into Central Europe in the next decade, and then, like a great wave receding, their move back east. Because their great Khan had died, it was sometimes said. Or maybe the Hungarian weather. But either way, that's not the world you're going to. Where you're going, things went differently. Mongol politics, the climate, technologies from China and Persia, the burning of the... But you'll see some of that for yourself. Perhaps it would be simplest for me to say that your destination is mid-13th century England. Which is to say, Mongol England. This is the England of the Jochid Khanate, sometimes called the Golden Horde. Its ruler, Batu Khan, son of Jochi Khan and grandson of Genghis Khan. Like our world, in those last respects at least. But in others, so very different. I can see you're impatient, though. All kitted out and unwilling to wait. And that's fine. They told me about that, too. So I'll jump right ahead and let you sort out the rest for yourself. This is a murder mystery. Ha! Got your attention? Good. I heard you were a fan of such things. That you studied some sort of late 20th century games on the topic. And even inflict some sort of bizarre murder nights on your more patient colleagues. Is that true, I wonder? Well, never mind. It's time for your investigation to begin. The killer is unknown, the scene uncertain. As I said, the timeline is confused, cloudy. But it very much appears that something is going to happen to Batu Khan. And I would like you to be there when it does. You will be entering the life of a Persian administrator attached to his camp. To be right there and to take it all in. And don't allow yourself to be distracted by other matters this time. Yes, I heard about all of that too. Now there's more I could say, but this is a mission of discovery, is it not? So go forth and discover. Just stand here and I will begin the process. As you know well enough already, this part will hardly take a moment. Just close your eyes and let the dizziness pass. Yes. Good. Good. You open your eyes, your head lowered. Cobblestones. Feet. And not just your own. Many feet. You look up. And find yourself in the middle of a street, low buildings lining either side, and all around you, people. They pass around you like water around a rock, some bowing slightly, some looking away, some openly staring. My lord, some say, with a measure of fearful politeness. Others mutter curses and spit, but not too near, not too loud. Ahmed. You look up at the sound of your name. It is Khadan, a Mongol captain of your acquaintance, cutting through the people towards you. They do not spit before him, but scatter, truly fearful this time. I knew it must be you. He is grinning widely. Tell me, did I catch you lost in logistical calculations, or was it lost in your own poetry again? Before you can answer, he's continuing. No, I've got it now. A poem on the maximum carrying capacity of 10 horses, and what fields they must eat from to manage it over 5 nights. That's what has you in a daze, or maybe too much Irag. But I know it's not that. So, tell me your poem. You open your mouth, and find that a poem does indeed come out. They build and say, we shall never die, but builders build for ruins. I have never encountered an intelligent person untroubled by the anticipated ruination. Ah, but I am not one for poetry, Khadan responds. Besides, a little grim, isn't it, on the heels of such a victory? He sweeps his hand about to take in the cowed figures scuttling past, the buildings beyond, the city of London, the recent conquest. It's not mine, you say distractedly, still trying to find your bearings. Ali ibn Abi Hashim of Baghdad. It's more than 200 years old. Well, let's not worry over him then. Come, are you bound for camp? I have horses waiting, just ahead. Yes, you think. Why not? Side by side, the two of you move up the street. Khadan's eyes alertly scanning the people around you. And now you have the time to notice it. They're a pretty sorry-looking lot. Many raggedly dressed and thin. Very thin. Following your gaze, Khadan nods. They should not have fled from their fields, especially not for famine in a place such as this. If they'd only stayed on their fields, then maybe their Edward the Long would not need to beg at our table. If they hadn't fled their fields, you answer him, then maybe our table would not be so full to beg from. Gadan chuckles at this, and then settles into something close to silence, as together, you collect his horses and ride south over the bridge and out of the city. The camp is a clamor of different tongues. Clusters of men from the Caucasus sit round one fire, and from Bavaria the next. At a third, Berbers, though by what routes they've come to find themselves here in England, even you're uncertain. You hear Persian, Latin, Arabic, Chinese, Turkic, Mongol, and more, each in their many different dialects. You have come to understand something of all of them, to speak more than a few. The interminable drizzle of this place has halted for the moment, allowing animal and human alike a respite from its droning, all-engulfing presence. You peer into the sky for sounds of its renewal, and a messenger approaches. The general wants you, the boy calls out, before running off on other errands. You nod in acceptance. The general. There is more than one commander of men in the camp, but the general could only mean one of them, Subutai. There are rumors among the men as to his age. Some swear that he enjoys some kind of immortality, though that is given to no man. What is harder to deny is his brilliance. It is said that he had been responsible for many of Genghis's victories. Certainly, he has been for many of Batu's. The burning of the German woods, the flooding of Paris, the poisoning of the very air in Cologne, the deployment of rumors, false orders, and disinformation that raced through enemies' territories, even before the initial raiding parties had done their work. It was all of it at Subutai's command. All of it, extremely, brutally effective. You pass the guards at the entrance to his tent, step over the threshold, and go inside. Within, your feet settle into the Persian rugs, their richness matched by the hangings on the wall, the work of artisans from as far as Linan and as near as Flanders, and by the golden vessels which stand ready, from the Black Sea region maybe, and filled with wine, both rice and grape, and the fermented mare's milk so favored by the Mongols. And then there, seated at the back and receiving reports, is Subutai himself, as distant from his birth as any of these items, but then, so are you. You let your feet carry you slowly forward, watching him, watching that face with its features carved in leather, its eyes scarcely seeming to be aware of their surroundings. But then they lock onto yours. You find yourself suddenly, painfully aware of your own limbs, and nearly stumble as you make the last steps towards him and wait to be acknowledged. You don't need to wait for long. Excellent, you've arrived. You are Ahmed, yes? The same who was part of organizing the crossing to this place, yes? There is scarcely space to respond between his rapid chopping words, but you confirm, yes. Yes, you are. Yes, you had. And the crossing didn't begin to cover the scale on which ships had needed to be seized or constructed to carry the conquering Mongol army to this last westward outpost. And when those ships had proven insufficient, the alternative had proven even more taxing, more distasteful. But you leave any such remarks out of your answer. Good, Subutai continues. You're going back. You wait. You'd heard nothing that the army was on the move. No mention that preparations were underway to return to the mainland and move south against the Nazarids. Or maybe elsewhere? Something of your curiosity must have been written on your face. We are not going on campaign, responds the general, to the question you hadn't asked. Just then, an aide rushes in with a message. Subutai grimaces in irritation, but still turns to hear him out. And without intending to, you take a half step forward yourself. Is this about your expedition? But you never find out. A quiet voice in your ear catches your attention, covering over whatever the general is hearing. It's the Great Khan. Whoever it is, they're close enough for you to feel the wind of their speech against your neck. The Great Khan's brother, Kublai, is coming. You let the words wash over you. They find no place within you to settle and make sense. Why would Kublai be coming? What did it mean? When the Khans were on the move, it always meant something. When the Khans were on the move, it was rarely without suffering for everyone else. Your mind snaps back to Subutai, those eyes now locked back on yours. The voice and its owner would have to wait. The general is speaking to you again. You're going back. Batu Khan is going back. We are going back east. There are matters there that will not wait. You'll see to it. It is not a question, and he does not wait for an answer. Already, he is on to some other concern. An aide provides numbers and a date, and you are bustled on and left blinking rapidly against the sudden light of the world outside. What were these matters that would not wait? And who else had been there in the general's tent with you and speaking in your ear? For now, the questions would have to wait. You grind the heels of your hands tiredly against your eyes. For days, you have been hard at work, making arrangements. Though to what end, you know not. You have been given a number, a day, and a tablet bearing the Khan's sign, for seeing done what needs to be. It is not pleasant. To begin with, there are the ships themselves, so many badly damaged in the initial crossing, and so little done about it since, as if any attention to such things would somehow indicate a willingness to abandon the island, to accept defeat and leave it behind. It was maddening. And then there is that other part. But you do not think about that just yet. Not until you must. You try to busy yourself with other things. Certainly, there are enough of them to occupy you. You ride out one day along the river to a place called Gravesend, your head full of distractions. Is it that town's leper's hospital, or the thing you must do, which troubles your thoughts more? Either way, you are inattentive, drifting with the movements of your horse, when an all-too-familiar hiss cuts through the air and startles you to attention. First the hiss, and then the wet thud of arrows finding their beds. You curse under your breath as a number of men around you tumble to the ground, the one closest almost falling into your lap on his way down. You urge your horse on into a gallop, some around you doing the same, while others veer off the path towards the arrow's source. How could you have allowed yourself such luxurious wanderings of the mind, as if sharing food and song among friends, and not following the grim line of these gray waters on an island full of enemies? You flatten yourself against the horse's neck as another arrow snakes past, the sound stretching out around you. You ride. A glance to the right at a blur of violence in the bush, but then you're snatched away, a thrashing, gasping, breaking of branches. Too quick to make any sense of it. Shouts, thuds, screams. But now they're getting more distant, dropping off behind you, receding. You find yourself alone in a clearing. You let your horse slow. There is still shouting further off, but the tone is different. And then you hear a more familiar voice. A horse, somehow, is next to yours, and a hand at your arm. I might have guessed I'd find you here. It's Gadon, a smile on his face and a cut just above his right eye. We were out hunting rabbits, he says. Lucky for us, they had something else on their minds. He looks you over. Not a scratch, I see. Come, my men are all through these woods, and any rabbits still breathing are running for their burrows. We can enjoy the day, and if you can pull yourself from your stupor, then I'd even be willing to hear one of your poems. He whacks you sharply on the back, and as you ride, you gather your thoughts and speak. The years passed, and the east wind blew. Even the ruins fell into ruin, tired playthings of time and the thunder and rain. Clan Heend lived here once. You can't visit them now. Fate has spun their thread. You fall silent, and at first he does too. You know, he says, a man could grow concerned for you in listening to your poems. Hear too many of them, and he might grow concerned for himself too. Another one you've dug up from 200 years ago? No, you say. 400. The warrior poet Antara ibn Shaddad. You'd like him. If you say so, he replies, somewhat doubtfully. I've had enough of ruins for now, though, I think. He has another poem, you say. One that begins, Damn the Ruins. Maybe you'd enjoy that more. He peers at you through narrowed eyes. I'm never quite sure if you're joking. Your day in Gravesend goes well enough. It does tire you to hammer home to one fool after another the urgency of their task, to secure one ship after another. Even the men who work in such matters seem to have little understanding of what an army needs to move it about. Food for such numbers does not arrange itself, nor can horses in such quantity eat whenever and whatever they please without problem, nor can so many men simply cross the waters without great cost. But you'd promised yourself you wouldn't dwell on that, not until you had to. For all your foul mood and the obstinacy of the craftsmen, the work is going ahead. The ships will be ready, and the rations too, though you shudder to think of the famine you will leave behind in this devastated place. Its people, who like so many others, will not recover quickly from hosting the Mongols as guests in their lands. The ride back to camp is largely uneventful. No more of Kadan's rabbits to trouble you. Indeed, no sign of the previous skirmish at all as you pass back through those woods. Only the begging of children by the side of the path intrudes on your thoughts. Are they the sons and daughters of local woodcutters or fishermen? Of soldiers? Of the rabbits? Are they orphans? You hand down some small coin or morsel from your saddlebags to the first few. But there are many, too many, and soon their pleas mingle with the raindrops, forming dull echoes in your head. You cannot stop there, nor can you as you enter the camp. There, a kind of ring has formed beyond the perimeter. It is, in a sense, surrounded by merchants offering all kinds of goods and services, by needy folk of all ages and offices. The army has taken what was available, and now these people have come to gain of it what they can. You see a squad of guards thrashing their way through one section of this temporary town and scattering its inhabitants. They'll be back, though. You know, just as well as the guards do. Their desperation is too great to allow them to do otherwise. As for you, you enter your tent, wet and exhausted, and make yourself comfortable as you can. You sit for a while with some writing, but you can muster no words of your own, only more of Antara's. Day by day, time takes aim and strikes from far away, then near. Wheeling, I watch a crush of woes grind me down. It thinks I've grown soft and weak, old and gray. Do time, what you will. Today is yesterday. I am the terror of the foe. But you very much fear you are not much like Antara. No fierce warrior poet, no terror of the foe. Giving up, you let sleep carry you away. The morning brings another messenger, again from the general, this time wanting to know that all proceeds on schedule. You assure the boy that he may in certainty report that it is, and you set about seeing that you don't make yourself a liar. Unfortunately, that means you must now see to the hardest of your tasks. You eat slowly, you're savoring the fragments of day, as yet untainted by what's to come. But not so much the food, that you scarcely taste, until at last, unable to delay things any further, you reluctantly set it aside and leave the tent. The hubbub of the camp outside captures your interest no more than the food had. On any other day, you'd have taken in the many tongues as you passed them by, your ears reveling in every new and unfamiliar sound as it slid into place alongside those you knew. But not today. Today, their voices may as well be the cawing of battlefield crows for all the cheer they bring you. Not even the clear skies above can bring you that. You give your horse a reflexive pat, climb up into the saddle, and begin your journey. You ride south, past fields torn by the pounding of horses' hooves, past farms that have been not so gently foraged, past people not quick enough to make themselves hidden at your approach, past others who are maybe past the point of caring enough to do so. You go through a village that seems largely unspoiled, the lack of any sign of life, lending it a strange atmosphere of peace. Only a door, hanging open on its hinges here or there, ruins the performance. Only the occasional object on the ground, the odd hurriedly dropped possession, a vessel or piece of cloth since ground into the dirt, gives sign of the fear that had swept through this place. Down one street, you see men loading the church bell into a wagon, its metal soon to be repurposed. A wood rises up before you and then, getting closer, reveals its clearings. The trees felled for some great works, maybe your own, you idly wonder, breathing in the smell of the still fresh cuttings. Or maybe as siege engines, maybe fortifications, maybe something else. Beside you, a member of your escort slows their pace and knocks an arrow. Following his eyes, you see two men seated by the side of the path. They make no move to acknowledge your presence, and around you, riders fan out, scanning the surroundings for signs of an ambush. But as you get closer, the situation becomes clear. You pause for a moment next to the men, their bodies frozen in a grotesque mimicry of rest, backs leaned against a log and throats gashed open. Burgundians, you'd guess from their attire. Recent enough, you'd guess from the fact they're still in it. For all the signs of war, you see, the day is pleasant enough. The ride pleasingly tiresome, numbing even. It is good to be away from the camp. At the relay post, you present your credentials, receive fresh mounts, and continue without incident. These are the horses that will carry you to your destination, the place this day is bringing you ever towards. The sun is starting to set as you come to the large beech tree and leave the path. Following the ridge of a hill for a time, you go past a stand of trees and up to the door of an unremarkable little house, somehow unmarked by recent events. You leave your escort to see to the horses and to themselves, and alone you approach the door. It opens. The face that greets you is set with wide, staring eyes. They roam in their sockets, but never seem quite able to settle on your own. The body beneath them is almost unnaturally still. Discomfited, you offer a greeting. You're not sure what, something stilted and entirely too formal. To this, the man only turns away, moving across the floor to a table and lowering himself slowly down into a chair. You step inside and allow your eyes to adjust to the darkness. Why is there no fire, no lantern or light? Only the last of the sun crawls across the threshold and shows you a little of the room. Not so much in its edges, mostly just that little square table with what you now realize is its single seat. That one occupied by your host, who now looks not quite at you, but off to the left somewhere, to the frame of the door. You advance a few more steps, leaving that door open behind you. You can hear the men outside, the noisy munching of the horses in the grass. It reassures you somewhat. You clear your throat, unnecessarily. "We require passage," you declare, also unnecessarily. For what other reason could you be there? The angle of his head changes, or do you imagine it? You lick your lips. "There will be 40,000 of us." Again, some stirring of the head. "Also, horses and supplies." The eyes are now over your right shoulder. "Is that all right?" No response. "Will that be all right?" You lean closer over the table. "I need to know, will that be all right?" The eyes wander up to meet yours, and in that moment, you very much wish they hadn't. You have looked upon the face of a mother who had dashed your baby to the rocks rather than expose it to Mongol cruelty, on the faces of thousands of prisoners from dozens of wars, Men who had lost both house and family. Men who had been taken from their Italian villages to the mines on the steppes. People who would never see home again. But there is something much more unsettling about this face, about these eyes and what they see. The man nods, slightly. You turn and flee, almost falling out the door and towards your escort. Your voice comes out harshly. Mount up! Darkness is closing in, but you will not be making camp any nearer that house than you need to. Any closer to that house, and what you know lies somewhere behind it. Wherever you come to halt, you know you will not sleep well. The return to camp the next day is uneventful, or at least unnoticed. Your men, sensing your mood, or at least your inattention, shepherd you along with practiced ease. On arrival, you make immediately for your tent, craving peace and rest. But getting closer, you spot the familiar messenger waiting by the entrance. It seems that the general wants to see you. You allow yourself a moment to collect your thoughts, and then make your way once again to Subutai. The bustle inside the tent has taken on the quiet urgency of imminent action. As you wait for the general's attention, you hear a low whisper just behind you. You do not look well, little poet. That voice again. You are turning to see who it is, but just then, you find yourself waved forward before Subutai, and immediately, you have his attention. He does not waste time. Tell me about the arrangements. All is ready, you answer. I have seen to the ships myself. I'm told the grain, meat, and drink are being loaded. How many by sea? He asks. 15,000. He nods, and for the first time hesitates before speaking. Tell me about the other way. I have been told something of it, but I want you to tell me. You hesitate too, and then begin, slowly at first, in the only way it has made sense to you. They are like silkworms, only larger, and we are both the mulberry leaves and the young. The threads they spin go elsewhere. They take us elsewhere. They will take us back across the waters again. But we will not cross the water. We will be there. We will hatch there on the other shore, even as our boats leave this one. It is very quick, you weakly conclude, looking for some sign of reaction in the face opposite yours. Tell me about the losses. You nod. There are losses. Again, you speak. When we get there, we won't all be there. Some will be lost. Not many. Not as many as many marches or sailings. But some. I don't know what happens to them. Other things will be missing too. I don't know what happens to any of it. And for those who do arrive, the way is quick. But it is not pleasant. I cannot describe it. I cannot really remember it. You wait for what seems a very long time. Old Subutai is famously open to new measures, new ways of doing things. But perhaps this particular way will be beyond even his endurance. You allow yourself to hope he will put an end to it. Finally, he opens his mouth. I will be going by ship. He looks at you questioningly. You sigh. I will take the other way. I cannot send others by it if I will not go myself. He nods. It is done. And so is your audience. As you step outside the tent, a hand claps you on the back, and Kadan is next to you. You were in there with me then, you say, nodding towards the tent and allowing a smile to cross your face, matched by his own. Of course, he laughs. You know I'm always with you in places of danger, in forest or in tent. And I'll be with you when we go. I'll see these silkworms of yours for myself. Somehow, you do feel a little better, knowing that he'll be there. Unlooked for and unwanted, the day of departure arrives. You look behind you at ordered rows of men stretching into the distance. Some arrived this way. They, for all that they can remember, know what is soon to come. Others, without that experience, are untroubled. they are easy to pick out. You're gathered at one of several such points around the countryside. This one, behind the house where you'd been the other day. As you'd passed it, you'd thought you might have seen that face, those eyes behind the window. But you didn't look too closely. Two by two, you approach the opening in the hillside. You glance up for a last look toward the sun angling down over the trees, and at Kadan beside you. You breathe in deep and step into the darkness. At first, there is nothing unnatural. Only the crowding sensation of so many entering the cave behind you makes it uncomfortable. But soon, the air warms. It becomes moist. You continue. Something is happening in your stomach. You shiver and sweat as if sick. There is light, though it's hard to say where from. Next to you, Kadan says something. Yells, maybe. You don't catch what. Brighter now. Warm. Your feet move forward of their own will. A hand grips your arm tightly, then is gone. You are no longer sure where you are. You come too, desperately gasping for air, panting for it, as if no amount will ever properly fill your lungs again. Your vision returns first. All around you are soldiers, but no longer in ordered rows. One in front of you gapes open-mouthed and pale at the sky. You look up, but see nothing there. Something bumps against your leg. It's another soldier, crawling unsteadily, body stricken and heaving with vomit. One beside him, digging at the dirt with his hands. Some huddle together, almost in piles. Others hug themselves. After that come the sounds. There is shrieking, wailing, moaning. All kinds of human noise. Hardly any of it words. You long for the previous silence. And then a thought strikes you. Kadan? You look down at your arm where a hand had held it. He is not there. You cast about, digging after him in the chaos around you. But he is not there. Is he lost?
That was The Con of England, Part 1, by Devin Field. You can find more by Devin at the Human Circus podcast, so please go check that out. It's a great show about the many faces, the many flavors of medieval life. It's well worth subscribing to. We are now at 112 patrons, which means we're well on our way to achieving our next milestone of bringing on a podcaster to grace the stage with a new show each month. Right now, we've got Kevin Valbonesi and Josh Hutchins on the team, and sometimes we have a little extra so we can bring on guys like Kristen Verboven and Devin Field. But when we hit 150 patrons, we'll be able to secure that third position. You can help us hit this target by becoming a patron, and you'll get over 40 shows only available to patrons, plus new monthly content, such as the Patreon show I'm working on now called Blue Dragons. Please visit patreon.com/twilighthistories, or go to our website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.